dry spell, the Summit County and the Summit and Wasatch County chapter of Habitat for Humanity is back in the business of home building. In the studio with an update, I have the executive director of Habitat for Humanity, Shelley Barris, along with board member Cheryl Butler. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
So, Shelley, when was the last time Habitat completed a home build? I believe in Park City, it was like up in Marsac.
So we had our last build was in Heber City. So that was a couple years ago that we finished that. And we have been spending our energy finding additional land where we could build more than one home at a time. So we're excited for that to be coming up.
Okay. So in terms of what you've got accomplished so far in Summit and Wasatch County, what are we talking about?
So over our span up here, we have built 14 homes. So we are excited to be looking at some additional projects to increase that productivity.
Yeah, and if you were to break that down in the Park City area, how many of those 14?
So in Park City, just the two up on Marsac Avenue, yeah.
So the majority in Wasatch County then?
Summit, in the eastern side of Summit County, Camas, Colville, Heber, and then up these two on Park City.
Okay, so the good news here is that you are working on several new builds. Tell me about those.
Right. So we have our initial two single-family homes are coming up. We're very excited to be working in Silver Creek Village, so out here in Summit County. So we're back on the side of Summit County. And those are, we're just in the building permit process right now, trying to get our submission for building permits, and we hope to be building this spring.
So how did you acquire those lots?
Right. Maybe Cheryl can share that with you. That's been a long process, and she has led our team, our volunteer team that has worked on that.
Yeah, so we have a land advisory council set up by the board to try to find land, because that's one of our biggest challenges here in Summit and Wasatch County, of course. And we've been working with developers all across both counties. Many of them have affordable housing commitments. And we try to work with them to say, hey, Habitat can help you meet those commitments. And we're very pleased that with our relationship right now with the Village Development Group, which is the developer at Silver Creek Village, they have donated multiple lots to Habitat. And the first two, as Shelley mentioned, will be coming up very soon. And those two will have a single family home on each.
Yeah, so the land was donated then.
That's correct.
As opposed to having to go out and purchase it, huh?
That's correct.
And that's not usually the case, or?
We have a variety of different agreements in the works depending upon who owns the land. And sometimes, absolutely, for example, City of Park City Municipal Corp, in fact, worked with us on the land here on the Marsac building, so it's not completely unusual. But in this particular case, the Village Development Group has in their development agreement that they signed with Summit County an option to donate land just for affordable housing. So Summit County was looking ahead to try to encourage the developer there to do exactly this.
All right. So how will these homes then be integrated into the Silver Creek Village? Because we're talking over 1,000 homes and condos and townhomes there.
Absolutely. And so these are part of what one of the subdivisions will be surrounded by market price units. You won't know that these are affordable houses. They're going to look and feel just like all the other ones in the neighborhood.
Okay. So those homes are already spoken for?
Shelley, can you tell us how that works?
Right. So we started our application outreach in January. We held several meetings in the community for information so people could come and find out what the process is like, how to apply. And then in February, we opened our application process, and we were able to do a lot of great outreach. We were able to utilize the list that the city already has for people that are looking for this kind of product. And we have closed that application process, and our Family Services Committee is in the process of reviewing those to make a decision.
All right, because somebody has to be chosen before the build actually starts, right?
That is.
That's part of the deal, is
right.
That they have to do some sweat equity work.
Right, so that's really why we try, as soon as we know this is happening, get the application process open and have our family selected. So as the build starts, they're involved from the very beginning.
All right, so who's qualified to even apply for something like that?
So our program is similar to a lot of the other programs, but it's income qualified. So we fit a little different category there. We do 30 to 60% of AMI. So just to give you an example, for a family of four in Summit County, you're going to be making between about $32,000 and $64,000 a year. And it adjust per your family size as well. So we're income qualified. You need to have, you know, stable income. This project actually has a deed restriction that has is prioritizing employment in Summit County. So you have to have worked in Summit County for a certain amount of hours for the past 2 years.
Now, do certain employees get priority?
So this development agreement doesn't have that requirement. So it's really just the employment, and I think Summit County and the developer and working in the development agreement wanted to, you know, see that we were housing our workforce, that we were trying to house people that are working here.
Right. So when you've got people working full time with kids, how do they find time to build the house, to provide the sweat equity?
Right. It is always a challenge, and we work with them on that, you know, that plan. And, you know, these houses don't go up in 3 months like some builders, and so we have a little bit more time to do that. And we have some other opportunities for them if getting out on the build site doesn't work. We offer some education courses along the way to be prepared for homeownership, and those count towards that as well. But we haven't really had a problem trying to figure out how people get on site, because they're very excited to be a part of their home being built.
Okay, so that's scheduled to get underway this spring then?
Yes.
Then they would be in their new homes by when? I mean, if you say it's not 3 months, but how long is it?
We're hoping to have the first two families in their homes this year. So that's our goal, and assuming we get all of the approvals and get out there and start working and the snow melts, we're not hoping for the snow melting. We like it as much as everyone else, but yes, our goal is to have the first two families in this year.
Okay, and you're also working with the developer for other lots then? Tell me about that.
Yes, that's a great opportunity for us. So we are in an agreement with that developer for some additional lots for some townhomes. So doing some more dense attached housing, we're really looking forward to that opportunity. More density allows us to build, you know, less expensively and house more families. So
how many are you talking about?
We are hoping it's a potential of up to 24 townhomes.
All right. Now, have you built townhomes before? Because you guys have always done single-family homes,
right? Yeah? We have not. At this Habitat affiliate, we have not. It's a product that is used, you know, across the country in Habitat, so it's not anything new to the program, but we're excited to put that product kind of in our tool belt.
Yeah, and when do you find out about that? I mean, when does that close, or...
So the
go.
Yeah, the plans are well underway right now. We are finishing up the architectural design so that we can submit it to the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, because the first step is to subdivide those lots into the appropriate, you know, plats for townhouses. And so we'll be working for the next few months with Snyderville Basin Planning Commission to make sure that that's all lined out appropriately. And then we'll jump right into finishing up the architectural design. So we're very excited. That should move very quickly.
Yeah. So do the homes have sustainable qualities? I mean, are we putting solar panels on them, energy efficient appliances, all of that?
Right. I think we are committed to building Energy Star, you know, and energy efficient for sure in all of our homes. But we are actually looking at a partnership to do the Zero Energy Ready Home program on these two for single family homes. And we're hoping that by going through this with these two homes, we can really expand it to the townhomes and work through that product. So we are definitely looking at some additional equipment and things that will help us with that.
Yeah, and certainly building home maintenance is a big cost. Are you putting on, you know, using stucco or vinyl siding as opposed to wood just to try and alleviate those costs, or are you required to build to a certain standard?
Well, I think that the development has specific design guidelines that we have to meet, and so we'll be meeting those guidelines, and I don't believe vinyl is one of the products that is in that, but you know, we also work really hard to help train our families as well through the process about long-term maintenance, and we're still a resource for them too, right? If they had questions or needed help about how to do that, and we talk a lot about savings, putting savings in place for those long-term kinds of costs.
And I think it does fit with the energy efficiency goals that we have for these homes, because we are willing to spend a little bit more upfront to put in equipment that's more energy efficient and saves our homeowners, you know, in their utility bills as they go forward. And so it all kind of ties together as well.
Okay. And I think there's a misconception out there that these are kind of free homes, but no, these people buy them, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And Habitat is, that's another way we're different than some other affordable housing programs, is we are actually the lender. And so the loan is with us. We have a long-term relationship with the families. But yes, they pay a mortgage just like every other homeowner, and they happen to pay it to Habitat. And one of the great ways about how we fund our builds is that's a piece of that. Those payments come into us, and they get recycled back into our building along with grants and donations and some, you know, resources from our ReStore. So we get some support that way as well.
Yeah. So for those who may have missed this last opportunity for the single family home, what's the process going to be for an opportunity at one of the townhomes?
Right. Very similar. So we will start getting it out in the community. We have a contact list that people can get on if they're interested. We're holding education classes along the way so they can get to know a little bit more, get prepared. But we will once again hold an open informational period and then an application period. So they, if you think you're interested, you know, get on that contact list, because as soon as it's open, we do a big outreach to people to let them know.
Okay, and how do they do that?
Oh, so they can come to our website, habitat-utah.org, and there is a contact information sheet they can fill out there. They can call our offices and talk to Brianna, who is our program person, and that's 435-658-1400.
Okay. Anything else you want people to know?
No, I don't think so. Thanks for letting us share this great news with the community. We're really looking forward to getting some shovels in the ground.
Okay. Shelley Barris and Cheryl Butler, thanks for your time this morning. It's 8:29. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, among other things, the Park City Council last night discussed affordable housing, special services contract, and the pedestrian tunnel under State Route 248. In the studio with a recap, I've got Councilmember Tim Henney. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start off with the long work session around some questions about affordable housing. One of the items was making adjustments to the affordable housing lottery, giving priority to applicants that fall under a certain category. Councilmember Gerber made a point to talk respectively about different jobs, that one job isn't necessarily more noble than another. You did decide, you, the council, that you wanted to pursue some sort of tiering system based on jobs for the housing lottery. So are we giving preference to one person over the other based on occupation?
Yeah, we're using occupation as kind of the filter. You have to pick some sort of criteria, and occupation is the one that we spent the most time discussing. You know, Becca's point is well taken, and it's around the term essential, and it's who, but so I think it's more the term than it is actually trying to create tiers and a preference system. It's a little bit of angst about that term. And Steve Joyce brought this up a long time ago when he was campaigning. He was talking about that term as well. But if you remove the term and you talk about trying to create a system that gives preference to people based on some criteria, we do agree on that, and we believe that's the right direction to go. So there's probably going to be a little bit of wordsmithing around the term essential. Kind of where we got to last night was, it's really, you know, what we're describing as essential could be called, this is too narrow, but first responders, critical responders, essential to the operation of the city. Those are all separate terms, but that's the idea. That's the concept behind it. So if there were something from an extreme snowfall to some catastrophic event, would we have people who lived within the city limits who could keep the city's necessary, essential functions for safety and welfare running? That's kind of where we're going with that. But then you can broaden it out and, you know, have another tier, maybe just below that tier, of people who contribute in some essential fashion to the identity, character, and values of the city. And that's where you start to get into those those in service of the community versus those in service of the private sector. So that's where this kind of gets a little murky and opaque, and we're trying to bring some clarity to that.
Okay, so it's not a lifty, not necessarily essential. That's the resort's responsibility to find a way to get that person to work.
Well, thanks for bringing that up, because, you know, that's a distinction that we're trying to make also. This is so multifaceted, but that distinction of a lifty. So if that lifty is a full-time resident of this community and is employed year-round, then maybe a lifty in the wintertime, but maybe part of the trail crew in the summertime, that would be a member of our community who could apply for our housing lottery and go into one of the tiers. I would believe it would be a lower tier, because that's not an essential or critical aspect of keeping the community running in that state that I described. But they would certainly qualify for affordable housing. Now, who are the employers, in my opinion, responsible for it? And we're working with this one. We're kind of wrestling around this one a little bit. But I think we all agree fundamentally that seasonal workforce that come and go from our community are the responsibility of the employers. Not every employer has seasonal employees, but there are some large employers that have a lot of seasonal employees, and they create a big impact. And I'm hesitant to call it a burden, because they bring great benefit and value to the community, and at the same time they create impact. So where, you know, what is that what does that ball look like? We're trying to deconstruct it and pull it apart and figure it out, but we do all feel that the seasonal workforce is the responsibility of employers. There's also a responsibility for employers who employ people year-round, and the city is one of those. We're the fifth largest employer in the community, and do we have a responsibility not only for our seasonal workers, which we are dealing with in our transit department, because we bring a lot of people in seasonally for our peak transit times, and we are beginning to house some of them as part of their package and to bring them to town and to have not dump them on the community as an impact or a burden, but also just the year-round residents. Should we, or year-round employees, should we be creating a, do we have an obligation or responsibility to create some housing for them? That's part of this conversation as also. It goes all sorts of different directions.
So the council, is it considering then following Park City School District's lead and purchasing a home for, say, the city manager?
Well, we had that conversation last night around one of the houses at Woodside One. We have a 3-bedroom house there that I think it's new construction. I heard it referred to last night as remodel, but I don't think it's remodel. I think it's one of the new homes. And it's on the corner, I think, as you're going up Park Avenue. So when you're heading south, it would be on the south end of the development. And it's one of the homes, a freestanding home. And we're having the discussion, do we pull that back? Do we hold that out of the lottery and carry it forward as an asset of the community and use it for housing of either the city manager or potentially the city attorney, the two employees of the council? They're actually the employees of the community, because, you know, at some point you get to being the employee of the community. And we have seen, there's lots of evidence, not only the school district here in Park City, but other communities that are facing the same challenges that we are with the affordability equation, the lack of housing, the inaffordability of housing to attract quality candidates. Yeah. And it's a real barrier. It's a real hurdle to get over. And we've seen numerous examples of communities that have done just this. And we're discussing the possibility of doing that with this one home in Woodside One.
Yeah, certainly, though, the city manager and the city attorney are the two highest paid staff members within the municipal government. I mean, if they can't afford to find a place to live, it seems like we're really in trouble then.
We are. Yeah, they're the highest paid employees in the staff, and it comes nowhere near being able to afford the median price home of $2 million. And, you know, I know that's a median home price, and there are other options within the community. But when you're talking, you know, any sort of home price in Park City from a comparable home where, you know, hypothetically somebody would be moving from another part of the country and selling a house for maybe $500,000. And then they moved to Park City and they got to buy one for $1.5 million. Our salary that we pay, which might be the highest in terms, in relative terms to other staff, is going to come nowhere near being able to purchase that home in this community. Big problem.
Also, another question raised was, how do you address, I mean, once somebody gets into this affordable housing and their job changes and their income levels change, are they get to stay or?
Gosh, you know, there's a couple aspects to that. But by and large, once they're in, they do get to stay. Life circumstances change. The belief is that it'll kind of self-select. If somebody, you know, you make compromises and sacrifices to be in affordable housing. So it's not going to appeal to people that don't have that as really their only option. So once your life circumstance changes and you're making more money, then the thought and the hope is that you would be able to purchase a free market house and participate in building wealth through the free market system. There is, in theory, greater opportunity in the free market because we limit the appreciation of the affordable homes and we have all sorts of, you know, different criteria. So there are limitations that you accept to be in it, and you give things up as far as potential return and wealth building. So our thought is that'll be a self-selection process.
Okay, moving on. A problem with parking at Deer Valley Resort. The resort has exceeded its allotted days to use street parking, putting stress now on the surrounding neighborhood. I think you heard from Steve Isowitz basically saying, you know, we had Sundance, we had World Championships, and we've had Little and Big Cottonwood close and all of those skiers coming over to Park City. So if that hadn't happened, we would have been okay so far? It's not okay. You live there.
I don't think so. I think even if you make some adjustment for special events and for big snow days that, you know, close down other canyons, so make that adjustment, still way over. I mean, the agreed to amount is something like 12. It varies a little bit because it's a percentage of the number of days that they're open, but Steve threw out 12 as kind of being a good workable average. And then they're at 27 this year, and you know, with no end in sight, other than the fact that they're going to close down in 3 weeks. But, you know, last Tuesday, they overflowed, a Tuesday in March with, I don't know, you know, what's going on now, spring break, or I think, you know, and it's hard to speculate. And Steve really advised us against speculation, and he addressed some of the speculation in the community. But the speculation is the Icon Pass has drawn a lot more what we would call day trippers from probably the Salt Lake Valley. Day trippers drive their cars. They want to park their cars. They have to park their cars somewhere. Right now, the only place to park the cars is at the base of the resort at Snow Park. And when those lots fill up, they overflow into the street. And when that fills up, I don't know what they do, drive around and, you know, park it in neighborhoods or in our satellite lots and where we have agreements. And I heard Todd Shallen addressing this with the county council through your story. So that's the only information I have on it. But it's not just an impact to the neighborhood around Deer Valley Drive and the Snow Park parking lots. This is also an impact that bleeds out into the rest of the community. It creates additional traffic and congestion and cars on the road. And if we have traffic jams that last an hour, our transit system fails and goes down. So there's a broad impact to the rest of the community. And we're trying to figure out how to align the goals of the community with the best interests of one of our bigger employers.
The council also approved spending almost $3.5 million on the construction of the bicycle pedestrian tunnel there at the high school and seminary. It's going to be the city's first green tunnel. Quickly, what makes it green and why does a tunnel need to be green?
Well, for snow melt, for one reason, there's also lighting, and then we've got some electric car chargers right there in the parking lots that are adjacent to the tunnel in the school lot. But it's really lighting and snow melt, and there's a snow melt system, and there are, this is kind of amazing, but there's new technology that allows the solar panels to be built into the railing, the guard railing of the tunnel, which will be at street level so that nobody falls into the tunnel and line the tunnel, and that's a solar collector, and we're going to power the snow melt and the lighting.
I share Councilmember Worrell's concerns. How do you get the student drivers out safely, as well as the folks across the street at Aspen Villa and Cook Drive? That Hawk Beacon has served as a way for that to happen. With that gone, now it's a free-for-all.
Well, if you look at the videos, it's kind of a free-for-all, even with the Hawk Beacon. But your point's well taken. That Hawk Beacon does create a disruption in the traffic flow, which then creates an opportunity for people to get in and out and merge. We already have a light at Comstock, and we have a light at Bonanza. So you have two lights that create the same opportunity. The feeling from the traffic engineers is we're not really giving much up, and we're gaining a tremendous amount with the ability to flow traffic there without having it come to a standstill whenever students cross, letting them cross underneath. And again, the Comstock tunnel is a good example. That one has been a phenomenal success, and so we're trying to get rid of these at-grade crossings and go underground.
Okay, Tim, I'm out of time, so thanks for yours.
You bet.
KPCW News Time now, 8:43. Good morning. Well, coming up Monday evening, the community invited to Leadership Park City's annual community lecture, this year featuring Vail Resort CEO Rob Katz. In the studio, I have the founder of Leadership Park City, Miles Raderman. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So again, this is Monday night.
This is this coming Monday night, the 18th of March at 7 p.m., and that's going to be at the Santee Auditorium. This is the 25th annual Leadership Community Lecture, and it's free and open to the public.
Okay. As I mentioned, it's featuring Rob Katz, and you selected him because he was available, or you...
No, I don't think Rob is often available. You know, he runs a very large corporation. But as I think most people know, that Rob is very dedicated to leadership training in his corporation. And as a leadership program, as a community leadership program, that's what interested me, that he spent so much resource and time training his own staff and making that such a priority. People talk about leadership, but there aren't that many corporations that really follow through. So I asked him about, probably 6 months ago, and he was gracious enough to say yes. And I think he likes to talk about this rather than just talking to investors and so forth. So he agreed to come.
Yeah. And usually the person that you line up agrees to talk to me, but he wouldn't do that.
Oh, I don't know if he won't talk to you, but I think he'll probably answer questions. The way we set up the evening, it starts at 7 o'clock. He'll speak for probably a half hour. I didn't see what he's going to say. I'm going to ask him questions for a half hour, so I will interview him. So I'd say key points that I don't think he's covered, I will try to ask him, but then it'll be open to the audience.
And I know you like to choose speakers that you, who will inspire, you know, your leadership class and other leaders in town. So how is it that you think that Rob Katz is inspiring in that sense?
Well, I've heard Rob speak before. I mean, I don't know him well, but he addressed some of our city tours when we were over in Vail one time, and when we were over in Breckenridge, he was nice enough to stop in. So I think he is dedicated to being available to the communities where they do business. I point out it's a corporation of over 40,000 employees, so it's a really big company, and most people maybe don't realize that. But, I read a lot in the leadership literature, and he's been honored by, number one, his alma mater at the University of Pennsylvania, which has a leadership institute, and he really does a lot of work with that. And then speaking to his employees, I mean, many of them here in Park City, but also in Breckenridge and in Vail and other places, I know that this is a sincere dedication that he has to trying to train his people. And I think it's not only his top people. I think they really stretch it out to the whole corporation. So I really wanted him to speak about that. Why are you spending so much effort? And do you think your shareholders are getting a return on that? He's a publicly traded corporation. And sooner or later, he has to answer to his shareholders. And I'm sure someone probably asked them, how come you're spending so much money on leadership training?
Yeah. So 7 to 9 p.m. Again, it's about a half hour and then another half hour with you, and then he'll open the other time?
Yeah, we'll open it up. I mean, he knows that's coming, so I'm hoping you'll be there. It will be videotaped. We're going to videotape it. And Bob just asked me outside, whether you could tap into the sound system. I'm sure you can. It's open. It's free. That's what leadership's all about. We're very transparent.
Okay. This is, as you mentioned, the 25th class.
25th year we're doing this. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
And have they picked a project, or you can't announce
They're going
it?
To pick the project. We meet starting at 3 o'clock that afternoon, so they're going to pick the project right before we do this lecture that night. So we've had a couple of proposals. They're required now to put in some proposals earlier, and so I know there's a few proposals floating around, and they'll argue with each other, and then they're going to vote, and they'll pick a class project, which we'll announce after they choose it.
Okay, majority rules, huh?
More or less. Usually it's been by one vote, but it is majority. Yeah, they've been very contentious about these, who gets what here.
Yeah, and have you chosen your destination for City Road Tour?
I have, and I've only whispered it to Mr. Bruff, who's gone with me for probably 27 years. So I'm not going to announce it yet. I'm going to, I promise I'd give him the scoop. And even though you're a good friend of mine, Mr. Bruff has accompanied me.
How was it? I got just a couple minutes here. How is it that we measure change? I mean, through leadership. Is there a way to
you know, I think a lot of people try to do it. And one way we do it, of course, is number one, how many people are still applying every year? You know, are people still interested in the community at this level? Because we tell, you know, in our literature and what I tell people is this is a chance to give back to the community. And of course, we have a lot of nonprofits that do the same thing. So we're not unique in that. But, we get over 100 applications a year for 30 spots. So people are still interested as we've grown. The second thing I look at is, have we fulfilled our purpose in helping key individuals in the community network with each other? And from the feedback I've gotten over all the years, I've been told over and over again that so many people who have been in the program said that they might never have done what they're doing now in terms of serving the community or nonprofits or their church or their community organization if they hadn't sort of been inspired in the program, or if they hadn't met someone else in the program who became instrumental in their lives. So I get a lot of credit for things which I don't deserve, but I'll take it because I get blamed for stuff too. But I think just the people dealing with each other, it's really been a really nice thing, just like the radio station. And we've kind of grown up together. Radio station's older, but as you know, you've been a big supporter of that. And the radio station has been a sponsor from day one just because we're all trying to build community here.
Yeah. So do you think Leadership Park City has done a better job creating leaders or creating community?
I'm more interested in creating community, quite frankly. You know, I guess there's all kinds of leaders, and some leaders. I'm looking for ethical leaders. I mean, I think there's a lot of leaders who might not be ethical. So we spend a lot of time about talking about community, talking about ethics, talking about social equity, and so forth. So we're not as interested in sort of the entrepreneurial end of it or making money end of it. I'm not opposed to that, but that's not really the focus of what we're doing here. So it'll be interesting to hear from someone like Rob, who's sort of trying to do both. I mean, he's trying to, I think, run an ethical corporation. And I'm sure people have questions to ask him and say about this or that. And, you know, I just heard Tim, who's as eloquent as anyone in the world, talking about the affordable housing issue and what's the role of the corporation in providing housing. And I'll ask him, and I'm sure other people will follow up on that. So these, you know, it's a squishy subject, but I think we've made some inroads here, because if you look at any nonprofit in this town, their boards or their executive directors, there's some of our graduates there.
Yeah. Vail Resorts did make like a $30 million pledge towards affordable housing. I'll send you that link, so maybe it's something you can ask them about.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that for sure. I've done some homework too, like you. I don't walk into these cold.
Okay, and I guess just wanted to mention real quick, you've got, again, the leadership. This is kind of on the downhill side of the year, and then you'll start accepting new applications.
Well, not until the summer. We put it online in the summer. We're all highly tech now. So starting in the summer, and they're all due sort of mid-August. But yeah, we'll advertise. I'll be back here, you know, giving PSAs and talking about it. But yeah, we love to have people who are interested in the future of the community, who are willing to give back to the community. That's what we're doing.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
No, it's been a good year so far. I'm happy to see the sun. I'll tell you the truth, I was getting some cabin fever. I heard you complaining about daylight savings time, but there have been one too many cloudy days here for me. And I see it's sunny out there. My dog's in the car. I'm going to go take a walk.
Okay, Miles, hey, thanks.
Thank you,
Leslie. See you Monday night. Well, Lucky Ones is celebrating its first anniversary. In the studio with details, I have one of the co-founders of Lucky Ones Coffee, Katie Holyfield. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
So, of course, this is the coffee shop there in the lobby of the Park City Library. How did the first year go?
It is wonderful. We are so excited to celebrate on Saturday. We thought no better way than to celebrate with this amazing supportive community. So we have a lot of fun, free community events going on all day long. We'll have the paint mixer coming in the morning at 10:30, 10:30 to 12. They'll be coming in to help everyone unleash their inner artist. In the afternoon, we'll be doing some karaoke from 12 to 1. And then followed up by that, we'll have the shop yoga studio. Randy, the yoga instructor, will be coming over, and we're going to clear the furniture out and do some free yoga in the coffee shop. And then at 3 p.m., we'll be doing some trivia. And all day long, we'll be having some drink specials. We have a couple happy hours going. So from 9 to 11 and 3 to 5, we'll be doing half-price drinks and $2 hot chocolates all day long. Just kind of as a celebration.
Okay. So the trivia happens at 3, and you do this every Saturday, yeah? Do you get a good turnout for it?
Yeah, we're still kind of building our base on it. There's some weeks where a lot of people come and bring friends, and I think through the holidays it got a little bit slow, but it's really fun. Bring a team, bring a smart device, and come join us.
Okay. So this year you receive free rent from Park City Municipal. Does that expire now?
No, we actually just re-signed our lease. So we had a 1-year lease with 2 1-year renewal options. And so we were fortunate that the city council decided that our lease did not need to be adapted after the first year. So they're going to be granting us that free rent through the second year as well.
So that's if you did not have that, would you have been as successful as you have been? Or
No, that is a huge part of our reasoning with the city council of asking for that first year of free rent and now the second year was we want to have an impact in the community. And a big part of that is the employment. And so if we were stressed and had to worry about wages, we wouldn't have been able to do and make the community feel that we have in our space. We started with 13 employees, and we now have 17. So just to grow and show that impact. And we counted up the other day, almost 7,000 hours of employment. So it's been incredible. It's been an incredible first year, and that is definitely giving us a leg up.
Yeah, and the employees, you tried to tap into that developmentally disabled contingent, right? Because they can make coffee, they can deal with the public, right?
Yeah, correct. And we actually open it up to all kind of different abilities. So we just don't like to categorize, and we don't ask when someone interviews. And so it's one of those that we see just a broad spectrum of it. And so we want to employ everyone. And it's been really incredible. We have had a lot of successes this year and just seen a lot of growth in our staff.
Yeah. What have you kind of learned over this past year?
I think one of the things is even some of the people that when we first hired on, we kind of knew going in that we would need a little more hands-on with, have come out and really surprised us that Tommy, one of our employees, he told us when he first started, the opportunity that he had in the past was 1 hour once a week was what he was working. And his mom thought maybe max would be 3 or 4. Over Sundance, he worked 46.6 hours for us and loved it. That would be, if he could have that schedule every single week, that would be Tommy's ideal schedule.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Again, it's happening tomorrow. You guys, your hours then tomorrow?
Yeah, we'll be open our normal hours, so 8 to 5. So we'll be celebrating on there all day, and our crew is very excited. So please stop by and see us.
Okay. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Katie Holyfield, again, one of the co-founders of Lucky Ones Coffee.